And of course, I guess all of you are medical students, I guess in different medical schools, and oh, I'm sorry, that's not the case? Okay.
Not all of us.
Okay, I apologize. I'm not aware of that. Some people are what? If you're not? Huh?
Pharmacy.
Okay, I apologize. But whether it's medicine, pharmacy, healthcare, of any type of nature, you're certainly going in a great, great Jewish tradition. As you know, the old joke they tell about the first Jewish president, and the mother is sitting in the audience, and someone asks, "Mom, you know, you must be so proud that your son is a president." And the mother says, "Well, his brother's a doctor." You know, so that's kind of the way it works. But really, we're talking about two different issues today, but they do overlap. One is the mitzvah to seek and provide medical care when there is an illness. That's kind of going to the doctor, so to speak. And the second question is more in the nature of preventative measures. What obligations must a person have to prevent them falling into that situation? To begin with, as the old saying goes, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So these are really two different issues. One is kind of, once a person is sick, once a person is ill, what are the halachic parameters? And then what are the obligations regarding prevention? Regarding the mitzvah of going to the doctor, it's very, very interesting that in the book of Exodus, the Torah says if one person damages another person, you know, I hurt somebody, I break their nose or whatever it is, so I am obligated to pay their medical expenses. That's what it says. Rapo yirapeh. So the Talmud has an interesting comment. If I'm obligated to pay medical expenses, that implies that a doctor is allowed to render medical service and charge for it. So from here we derive that the doctor is permitted to charge for medical expenses. Now the question is, why do I need a derivation? What would my thought have been without this? So you know that there are religious traditions, such as Christian Science, that actually make a theological argument against the legitimacy of medical intervention. And their argument is that everything that happens in the world is directed by God. And if God made you sick, it was God's will that you be sick. And for you to seek to change that status quo by any type of intervention, pharmacological, surgery, or the like, is a wrongful interference with the divine. Now, this may sound a little bizarre, but in point of fact, well-meaning Christian Scientists, and these are not wackos, these might be professionals in the community, very upstanding people, they will not give themselves or even their children medical treatment because it is wrongfully interfering with God, according to their system of belief, and they will only seek to alleviate illness by prayer, meditation, or the like. Every year, there are criminal prosecutions of Christian Science parents for child abuse for not providing medical treatment to minors, because one on their own can say, "I don't want to be treated by a doctor," but the state will step in if you don't provide medical treatment to a child. Now, these are not abusive parents. These are not parents that are, you know, taking a metal pole and beating their child. This is their religious belief, and it's a very interesting constitutional law issue. When does freedom of religion yield to the state's compelling interest? And the long and the short of it is that vis-a-vis children, your religious beliefs, even as a parent, cannot endanger children. That is treated as a compelling state interest in which the state can take over the role of the parent. So what the Torah is telling us in Exodus is that we reject that theological postulate, and it is totally legitimate to seek out medical intervention. And that is not inconsistent with faith, because the same way that God gives you your sustenance, but you have to go get a job, you can't stay in bed and have the money accumulate, and the same way that God gives you food but you have to put it in your mouth, so too, this is called in Hebrew hishtadlut. Hishtadlut is the requisite human effort that is necessary for divine blessing. So too, the seeking of medical treatment is within the permissible ambit. Now, I didn't yet say it's a mitzvah. Remember, we have to follow this sequentially. The verse in Exodus does not establish a duty to go to the doctor. It simply establishes a permissibility. Now, we'll discuss in a moment, does it become a religious duty? but it is permissible because it is not inconsistent with faith to seek divine intervention. Now, this goes back to the idea that in Judaism generally, faith, the Hebrew word for faith is emunah. Emunah is not quiescent or passive. In some faith traditions, particularly Eastern religions, the notion of faith is you simply sit back and whatever happens, happens. And there's kind of an acceptance. That is actually, the philosophical term for that is quiescence. It's a certain passivity in looking at the world. In Judaism, faith is very much an activist faith. It is a faith that also imposes on human beings a sense of responsibility and initiative. This manifests itself in many, many ways. If there's injustice in the world, we don't simply say either God will fix it or this is what God wants. We fight the injustice. We drain the swamps. We kill the mosquitoes that are causing malaria. We don't take the attitude that if there's a problem, God will either fix it or God wants it to be there. And it ties into the idea that part of the implication, one of the most important verses in the Torah, is that man is made in the image of God. That's called the foundation of the Judeo-Christian ethic. Emphasis on Judeo, because that came first. Now, when we say the human being, when I say the human being is made in the image of God, we certainly don't mean a physical image, because God does not have a physical image. But we mean that the human being has godlike characteristics of free will, autonomy, creativity, intelligence, the ability of abstract thought, and the ability to translate those thoughts into concrete actions. So we are godlike. We are given many godlike capacities, and we are supposed to be God's partner in alleviating the misery of the world. And as a result, therefore, the practice of medicine or technology of any sort is not a violation of the divine. It is not a contravention of the divine will. But it is part and parcel of our mission to be partners with God. And this is also a very well-known Hebrew term, tikkun olam, to make the world a better place. Okay? So what the Talmud is teaching us in that book, Pasuk in Exodus, is we are not Christian scientists. In case that would not be immediately obvious. By the way, there is another aspect to what the Talmud is teaching us. The Talmud is not only teaching us that you're allowed to practice medicine, it's also teaching us you're allowed to charge for practicing medicine. Well, why is that a problem? So here there's a very interesting point. Generally speaking, when you are fulfilling religious obligations and mitzvot, you're not supposed to charge for them. Mitzvot are supposed to be done for free. Theoretically, rabbis are not supposed to get paid. Now, we have worked out various doctrines that permit us to get paid, such as we are not getting paid for our rabbinical services. We are getting paid for the income we are foregoing by not pursuing something else. You know, a bit of a loophole in that way. But in that light, a physician technically should not pay because a physician should not get paid because a physician or a pharmacist for that matter as well, and even a nurse, are all doing great mitzvot in sustaining life and giving people health and the like. So the Torah has to say they're allowed to charge, right? So that's yet another aspect of it. Okay, now, starting with the very basic predicate that medical intervention is permissible, let's now go to the next level. Let's say it is permissible, but is it mandatory? Let's say I'm a very righteous person, and I say, I don't want to go to doctors, I don't want to seek medical, I don't want to take medicines, I just want to pray. Am I permitted to take that stance? Right, that's a different issue. The permissibility of medical intervention does not yet turn into making it mandatory. So here, I have to point out that once the intervention is permitted, it does become mandatory, because halachically, we are obligated to safeguard our health. It becomes a mitzvah. It is a mitzvah on the patient to seek, and it is a mitzvah on the physician or the healthcare provider to provide. Two different mitzvahs. The mitzvah on the patient to seek, and this is going to overlap with preventative health as well, is a verse in Deuteronomy, V'nishmartem ma'od l'nafshoteichem. You must guard your soul. And that means you got to keep body and soul together. So that's the mitzvah on the patient to seek. What is the mitzvah on the healthcare provider to provide? So this is very fascinating. You know, there's a mitzvah in the Torah of returning a lost object. If I find your wallet or your dog and I know who it is, I'm supposed to hold it and call you up. Or if I find something without identification, I hold it and I put up a sign. There's actually a mitzvah called returning lost objects. So the Talmud makes a very interesting bit of reasoning. If I have to return your wallet, how much more so should I have to try to return your health, which is more important than your wallet? So in a sense, it's very, it's a kind of an odd derivation. The mitzvah of providing medical treatment is what is called an a fortiori reasoning from the mitzvah of returning lost objects. So we've established three basic propositions. Medical intervention is permissible. It is not a contravention of the divine. That's principle number one. Principle number two, there is a mitzvah on a person in need to seek such intervention. Based on the verse in Deuteronomy, you shall guard your soul. And number three, there is a mitzvah on the healthcare provider to render such assistance. Actually, there are a few derivations. One derivation is the mitzvah of returning lost objects. The other is a pasuk in Leviticus, a verse in Leviticus, do not stand by idly over your friend's blood. That's Leviticus 19. So the physician or the healthcare provider is fulfilling both a positive commandment and a negative prohibition of don't stand by idly over your friend's blood. By the way, I do want to point out that this mitzvah of not standing by idly when somebody is in trouble is not limited to physicians, nurses, or pharmacists. It actually applies to anybody. If I see, for example, somebody getting beaten up, I have a duty, halachically, to call the police or intervene in a way that doesn't endanger me. Meaning, you cannot stand by passively if somebody is suffering. Now, obviously, the nature of what you're supposed to do is a function of your training. So, for example, if I see somebody get a heart attack, the Torah is not commanding me to do open heart surgery. Because, frankly, I wouldn't know what to do, and it's likely that I would do much more harm than good. So how you help somebody is a function of training and ability. But that you must do what you can within the bounds of your knowledge, that applies to everybody. So I remember, as you know, under Anglo-American law, there is no obligation to intervene. Meaning if somebody is drowning and I could easily throw them a life preserver, I do not have to do so. If I'm driving by and there's an accident, I do not have to stop to help the victim. Now, historically, it was even worse. If a person stopped and helped the victim and something went wrong, they could be liable. Many states have enacted Good Samaritan statutes, particularly for physicians, that will immunize them. But there's still, unless you have an existing doctor-patient relationship, generally speaking, there's been some changes lately, but generally speaking, there is no duty to stop to intervene. Do you remember the last Seinfeld? Apparently there is a law in New Hampshire or Vermont or something that you do have to stop, or whatever it is, but generally that has not been the American legal system. I remember years ago reading an editorial, or a My Turn column in the Newsweek, which is no longer a magazine, it's no longer published, but it was a competition with Time, and a medical resident was writing that he first felt he became a doctor because one day he was driving on the New Jersey Turnpike and there was an accident and he stopped and he did mouth-to-mouth resuscitation and he did some other procedures until the ambulance got there. And he was very proud of himself. He really used his medical education. And he comes back and he tells his attending physician, his supervisor, that today I was a doctor. And the supervisor looks at him with annoyance and said, "You stopped? Are you nuts? Are you crazy? You could have been sued, you know, for $1 million. Never stop." That crushed the person's spirit. He realized that even medicine can become a business, can become kind of a preoccupation with liability instead of a helping profession. All I would say is that the Torah rejects that whole philosophy. Leviticus 19 says, it's not enough not to hurt people. You have an affirmative obligation to help people. Do not stand by when somebody is suffering. Those who are passive are as guilty, well, not as guilty, but they do bear a measure of guilt as bad as the perpetrators. Right? It's not enough not to hurt, you gotta help. Now, so these are our three basic propositions: permissibility to obtain medical treatment, obligation to seek it out when necessary, and mitzvah to render it on the part of the healthcare providers. Now, there is one issue I'm not going to address, and I assume that you will have lectures on this. When I say there's a mitzvah to seek out medical treatment, I don't necessarily mean it has to be conventional Western medical treatment. I'm not defining for purposes today what is legitimate medical treatment, what is not. This is not a halachic question per se, this is a scientific question, meaning halacha is kind of neutral as to what is good medicine, what is not good medicine, what is quackery, what works, what doesn't work. And halacha could be open to all sorts of things, whether it's acupuncture, alternative medicines. Generally speaking, based on the state of scientific understandings, we generally would not encourage a person to abandon all conventional medical treatment to just go the alternative medicine route, simply because the efficacy has not been well established. But that's really an empirical question, meaning it's certainly entirely proper to augment conventional medicine with alternative treatments, even things like hypnosis and biofeedback and imagery and recognizing mind over matter. But all I'm saying is, it's not a matter of religious principle, it is simply a question of therapeutic efficacy. And I'm willing to say that perhaps conventional medicine is too negative regarding the possibilities that might exist. So I'm not addressing that. In other words, I'm not saying halacha says you gotta go under the knife. But halacha does say you can't just leave it to prayer. You have to actively seek out some type of therapeutic alternative that will be efficacious. Okay, and what that is really left to the realm of science and the like. Okay, so now physicists tell us there is matter and antimatter, and opposites can exist in the world. Well, that's certainly true for the Jewish tradition. In spite of everything I told you, you will often find dissenting voices. And that's kind of the richness of Judaism, that there are many, 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 many voices. The mainstream position and the normative halachic position is exactly as I've told you, but there are dissenting voices. And that is the following. There is a view that actually says, ideally, one should not go to the doctor. Ideally, one should turn to God for refuah, for healing. And this is a passage in the Talmud. One of the righteous kings of Israel that is mentioned in the Bible, perhaps you've heard of him, is Hezekiah. In Hebrew, it's Chizkiyahu HaMelech. Very, very righteous king. And the Talmud mentions certain things he did, the sages approved of, and certain things he did, the sages did not approve of. And one of the good things he did was, he took a book, an ancient document, that was called Sefer Refuot. Sefer Refuot means the book of cures, the book of healing, and he concealed it. He withdrew it from public circulation. Very enigmatic. What is the Sefer Refuot? So apparently the Sefer Refuot was an ancient physician's desk reference, a PDR, that listed all the known medications and what they were good for, and he took it away. And that was called a praiseworthy act. But the Talmud doesn't say, why was it praiseworthy? So listen to this. This is such a beautiful example of the richness of Jewish thinking. The great commentator Rashi writes that the reason he took away Sefer Refuot is people were relying too much on drugs and they were not seeking healing through God and mitzvot and meritorious action. So he curtailed access to medical information to force people into a spiritual modality. Shades of Christian Science, almost. That's what Rashi says. However, there's an alternative explanation of the same passage that is offered by Maimonides. Now, you might suspect that Maimonides wouldn't like Rashi's interpretation, because as I hope you all know, Maimonides had a triple career, triple header. Maimonides was the greatest halachic scholar of his generation, and he wrote the great, magnificent codification of Jewish law. Maimonides was the preeminent religious philosopher of his generation, in which he wrote The Guide to the Perplexed. And his third crown was he was one of the most eminent physicians of his generation, a master of medicine. He wrote a number of medical treatises, and I have to say, the medical treatises are perhaps a bit more dated than the Maimonides lived in the 1200s. They're a bit more dated than the halacha and the philosophical works. But I have to say, Maimonides did, even then, identify a number of fundamental principles that are still very important. The importance of nutrition and exercise as mechanisms that prevent illness. Maimonides is very, very clear. In fact, there's even a diet book out with a Jewish spin. It's called the Maimonides Diet or something. They basically, you know, take his recommendations and try to translate it into modern foods and the like. So that way you have kind of a religious source for the particulars of that diet. But as you would expect, because Maimonides was a great physician, he would not accept an interpretation that says, don't go to the doctor, pray to God. And in fact, Maimonides cites the Talmudic passage of Chizkiyahu concealing the Book of Cures. He quotes this interpretation of Rashi and he ridicules it. And he says, he who says, I will not go to the doctor because God will heal me, is as foolish as the person that says, I will not put food in my mouth, God will feed me. Well, yeah, but that's how God feeds you. You know, they tell the joke. It's not so funny in light of things that have happened. But a person that's caught in a flash flood, and he's a great believer in God, and the water is getting higher and higher and higher, he's on his porch, and he has to keep on going into the house, second floor, attic. And every time, there are boats that come by, speed boats that want to rescue him. There are helicopters with rope ladders. There are airplanes. And every time, he simply says, I don't need you. My Lord is going to redeem me. And he climbs to the first story and the second story, and the water's getting higher and higher, and eventually he goes to the roof, and the water is coming up past the roof, and he realizes his moments are numbered. And in his last moments of life, he cries out in agony to the Almighty God and says, God, why have you rejected your faithful servant? And God answers him. He says, I tried to save you 5 times. I sent the rope ladders and I sent the helicopters. How did you expect me to save you? Now, there are times in our history where God simply splits the water, like the Red Sea. But you know, that doesn't happen that often. And according to Jewish law, you're not supposed to assume there'll be miracles. Everything comes from God. A believer believes that health comes from God. But God requires, Maimonides says, that we use natural means. But, problem is, Maimonides is confronted with a Talmudic text that says the contrary. Maimonides now has the burden of explaining, so why did Chizkiyahu take away the Book of Cures if people are supposed to use this stuff? So listen to what he says. It's almost as if the AMA wrote this. Maimonides writes, the problem with the Book of Cures was that making it available to lay people, uneducated lay people were self-medicating and they were making their own decisions what treatments were appropriate, what treatments were not, and that was destructive. So he withdrew the Book of Healing, not to prevent people from seeking medical intervention, but to make them seek medical intervention by taking the information out of the hands of the uneducated lay public. So we have Rashi and Rambam, and they give radically opposite interpretations of the same Talmudic passage. According to Rashi, medical intervention was discouraged so people would seek spiritual healing. According to Maimonides, the withdrawal of the book was to force people to go to doctors because they could no longer self-medicate. This really mirrors an interesting issue that you're going to face, physicians and pharmacists, all healthcare professionals face this. And that is, in the olden days of medicine, some people say the good, many doctors say the good old days of medicine, basically, medicine was a black box, meaning to say the patient had to trust the doctor. Medicine was mysterious, it wasn't really explained. And either the doctor was a real gruff authoritarian figure, or a nice guy like Marcus Welby or whatever it is. But the concept basically was the doctor told you what to do, and that was it. You know, you didn't question, you really had no basis for judging. Now, because of the proliferation of the internet, every patient has access to masses and masses of information, much of which is junk, much of which is false, some of which is true, and the patient really is not in a position to know. But as a result, medical decisions are constantly being second-guessed, meaning to say, you as a physician will tell somebody something. Well, they'll go, well, I read on the internet, you know, so-and-so and so-and-so. Now, don't be arrogant. Sometimes there may be some kernel of wisdom that this patient discovered that you were not aware of. That's very, very true. But it's really kind of a needle in a haystack, you know, there's so much junk out there. So doctors are, you know, divided overall. Is this a good thing or a bad thing? Some say it's good because it allows patients autonomy and control over their lives. Others say it's bad because it's, you know, not allowing physicians to, you know, do exercise their judgment because they're being second-guessed by people who are not in a position to evaluate them. It's really a contradiction between the principles of beneficence and autonomy. You know, beneficence is, I'm going to do the best thing for you, which is more paternalistic, versus autonomy means you're the guy, the patient is the one that's in charge of the show. And this is a recurring conflict in balancing these two imperatives, autonomy versus paternalism. And that's why a lot of, you know, a lot of old timers like prefer the old way of practicing medicine. You have already been raised in the new ethic, so perhaps you're not even familiar with the older medical ethic. But you know, this permeates many, many areas. For example, it used to be that if someone was suffering a terminal illness, the doctor might not even tell them that they're dying, because the doctor says, well, I've decided not to upset them. You know, things like that, which are really or informed consent. In the olden days, before litigation, if a doctor thought a surgical procedure was fine, he had you sign on the dotted line and just did it. He didn't have to tell you every single risk that would happen, because that would scare you, that would horrify you. Even now, you know, you buy aspirin and there's a list of warnings, you know, person, I'm not gonna take Tylenol, it's just too dangerous. Okay, now, so there is the mainstream position, as I said, but as I say, we do have Rashi's voice that may have suggested better pray than go to the doctor. Now, I'm going to mention a final text, and then I'm going to proceed to part two of our presentation. And with all apologies to the people that might be hurt, the Talmud in Tractate Kedushin talks about different professions and lines of work that one should pursue. And it ends with a comment about physicians. So the pharmacists are lucky here. There's no condemnation of them. And it says, Tov Sheberofim, the best of the doctors, the Gehenim, they can go to hell. So it's kind of a very summary dismissal. The best of them is worthless. So the question becomes, well, we just talked about it being a mitzvah, and you're doing God's work, and you're helping people live. Why does the best of the doctors go to hell? They tell a story. In the 19th century, there was a great rabbi who was very, very ill. And a physician was treating him. But in the middle of the night, the physician basically said, this guy's going to die. I'm going to go home and get to sleep. There's no reason for me to be here. And the physician basically abandoned the patient because he said he's going to die anyway. Well, lo and behold, a miracle happened. And the rabbi recovered. And 3 weeks later, he's walking in the street and the physician sees the rabbi who he left as dead 3 weeks ago. And the physician turns white, blurts out unthinkingly, I thought you were dead. So the rabbi says, I did die, but I went to heaven and I did you a great favor. I went to heaven and I saw gates up there and I saw a long line of people and you were in that line. And I asked the angel, what is this the line to? And the angel said, well, this is the line to hell, and all these people are doctors. And I said to the angel, let that man go, he's no doctor. Meaning he abandoned his patient. So I got you out of hell because you're not a doctor. Okay. But what is the meaning? The best of the doctors go to hell. So a simple interpretation is simply this. The best of the doctors means the doctor who fancies himself so great that he's unwilling to consult with colleagues that he regards as his intellectual and professional inferiors. If as a result of arrogance your patient suffers, God will hold you responsible for that harm. Meaning paradoxically, the middle of the road doctor might be less prone to that mistake because he knows, he doesn't know, he's going to talk it over. The arrogant person might be very, very reluctant to admit mistakes, might be very reluctant to consult with a senior colleague or even a junior colleague. And what the Torah is teaching us, what the Talmud is teaching us, is the very, very important idea that if your arrogance results in somebody's prolonged suffering, even if it's not a death issue, just if they're uncomfortable one more hour than they had to be, because you didn't want to revisit your decisions, you are responsible. Now, we're going to have a class on malpractice, and it is true that if the doctor did the best that they could, and there's an untoward result, obviously you're not responsible for bad results. Things happen, things beyond your control, and even if in retrospect there were things you could have done differently, as the saying goes, hindsight is 20/20. And that does not automatically mean that you're culpable if you utilized your best judgment at the time. And we'll talk about it. Again, the halacha of malpractice is similar more or less to the secular standard of malpractice. Bad results are not malpractice. But if as a result of arrogance you did not do the consultation that would be expected, then indeed, even if the patient suffers like 15 minutes of pain that they wouldn't have to suffer, all right, so maybe that's not going to be a malpractice lawsuit. The patient might not even realize what happened. But God knows, and that's a solemn responsibility. So that's one explanation of the best of the doctors. It's not a put-down of medical practice. It is a put-down of arrogance and conceit that hurts people. Humility is a very, very important trait in life generally, and maybe even more so in the practice of medicine, although I wouldn't say it is a common characteristic of physicians. Okay, now there's another explanation which utilizes what is called gematria. You've heard of gematria, it's the same word as geometry, but it's not geometry, but it is numerology. Gematria simply says, we take the Hebrew alphabet, and every letter is given a number, just like A could be 1, B could be 2, so Aleph is 1, Bet is 2. So let's take the gematria of the word Tov. Tov is the best, the good. So Tet is 9, Vav is 6, so 9 and 6 is 15, and Bet is 2. That's so together, the gematria of Tov is 17. So, Tov Sheberofim means the doctor who believes in 17. What's the reference to 17? We know that every day, three times a day, a religious Jew has a certain prayer that has 18 benedictions. It's called the Shemona Esrei. So Tov Sheberofim means the doctor who believes in only 17 of the blessings, not 18. And one of those blessings is God is the source of healing, meaning he attributes his success to himself. So if he's only a 17 blessing guy and not an 18 blessing guy, he goes to Gehenna. By contrast, if he's an 18 blessing guy, the word chai, life, adds up to 18. So Tov is 17, chai, life, is 18. Now, many of you may have heard of Dr. Ben Carson. Actually, he's a bit more famous now in the general press. Ben Carson was the chairman of neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital. He was a great neurosurgeon. He separated conjoined twins a number of times. Very, very delicate, difficult surgery. But he has a compelling history. He's a black man. He grew up in a single family, single parent family, only his mother. His dad was long gone, in the ghettos of Detroit, and impoverished. And all of his childhood friends are either dead or in jail. And both because of his remarkable mother and because of various adults, great, great adults that he met in his adolescent years, his life took a different turn. And he goes back to the ghettos and he talks to kids, giving them hope and showing them that they can make something useful of their lives. In fact, he himself had an epiphany. He was in a gang and he was on the road of getting involved in drugs and violence. And one day in a fit of rage, he took a knife and he stabbed somebody. But the knife hit a belt buckle and it broke. The knife broke. And then he realized in that moment that his life was out of control and he needed to rein himself in and become somebody. So he is a deeply religious person, although not a Jew, he's obviously a Christian. But he talks about the fact that before he does the most delicate of neurosurgery, you know, brain surgery, he prays to God and he feels the divine energy of God guiding his hands as he does this and that. That gives him a sense of serenity, a sense of connectedness to God, in which the divine energy is enabling him to do his job. Now that doesn't mean he didn't have to study and he didn't have to work real hard to become what he became. But ultimately, when he connects to divine energy, that gives him the wherewithal to do what he needs to do. And that is, again, a beautiful concept that a physician, anyone in the healthcare field, should regard themselves as an emissary of God to bring divine blessing into the world. And if they do that, God will give them the abilities to be a conduit. You know, there's a beautiful custom in Jerusalem, it's not that widely practiced even in Jewish hospitals, that, in fact, they don't even do today that much, but when Shari Tzedek, have you been to Shari Tzedek Hospital, or you will be there. Shari Tzedek is really a world-class hospital, but it is run entirely according to Jewish law. It's quite amazing, meaning they do everything there, but they find ways of following the Shabbat and the holidays and still, without compromising medical treatment, really, technologically, it's quite remarkable. But when Shari Tzedek was founded in whatever it is, 1920s, you know, a real long time ago, so, you know, it didn't have, you know, it was a relatively primitive hospital in those days because Palestine was relatively primitive. This is before there was a state of Israel. But Dr. Wallach, who is the founding physician who founded Shari Tzedek, he would interview every patient. He would take the diagnosis of every patient. And he would also take their Hebrew name and pray for them. So side by side with the medical treatment was, we'll pray for you also, because that's part of what helps. We have to give you medical treatment, but we also have to pray for you. And that was it. Okay. So I guess the bottom line is that all of you, in whatever branch of healthcare you'll be moving into, are doing God's work. You're doing a great, great mitzvah. You need to approach it with humility, a sense of responsibility, a sense of awe, and a sense that it is Hashem, it is God, that will be the ultimate guarantor of whatever success you will enjoy. And it doesn't hurt. Now, I understand in a pluralistic society, you know, you can't necessarily tell a patient who is not religious or is of another religion, you know, let's pray to God. But I will tell you, in your own mind and in your own heart, you could do much worse than to pray to God before every type of procedure, every decision, every prescription, whatever it is you're doing. A silent prayer of the mind is something that could be very, very appropriate. As far as I know, separation of church and state does not prohibit your thoughts. So you can, as long as you keep your religion to yourself, you can have it in your mind and in your heart as well. Okay. So now let's talk about part two. And part two is the issue of preventative health. And obviously, this is something that's very, very, very important. To some degree, society addresses it from the economic standpoint. And that is, medical care is extremely expensive. It consumes an enormous part of our budget. And indeed, of that enormous healthcare budget, I believe more than 25% is spent on care of terminally ill people in the last week of their lives. The last 7 days is 25% of the healthcare budget, which is just phenomenal. And it is recognized that we could save a tremendous amount of money, but it's much more than that. It's not just a question of saving money, as important as that might be, but it's a question of quality of life. It's a question of enhancing longevity. It's a question of giving people more opportunities to enjoy life and to contribute in positive ways. So let me just say that although historically the medical profession has not been a particular proponent of preventative measures, possibly because it would hurt their bottom line, they would be making less money, but I think everybody recognizes. And as I pointed out, Maimonides himself, going back almost 1,000 years, talked very much about the diet, nutrition, exercise. And again, I feel a little bit critical because this is something that I have to be conscious of myself, and God willing, I'm going to try to follow what I say. So this is one of those lectures at this point where I have to say, do as I say, not as I do, yet. But okay. But let me just give you a little background. And that is, halakhically, there actually is an obligation and a responsibility to safeguard our health. And this is derived in a few different ways. Derivations are interesting. The Torah says, for example, that if you have a flat roof that people walk on, you are obligated to build a fence around that roof, lest somebody walk on the roof and they fall off. Right? This is called ma'akeh. Now, at one point you might say, well, that's a pretty narrow, specific commandment. But in the Talmud enlarges it way beyond the parameters. And that is, do not maintain dangerous conditions on your property. Right? So if there are holes, fill them up. If there are toxic cesspools, drain them. So that is kind of a responsibility to eliminate hazards and dangers in your environment. Okay, so that is derived from ma'akeh. Now, what about taking care of my health in terms of exercise, diet, and the like? So that is derived from that same verse I mentioned, going to the doctor, you should guard your soul, means you have to take care of your health in a responsible way. And there are actually laws that say you are not allowed to engage in dangerous activities. Now, this raises some very, very difficult questions. You are not allowed to do things that are dangerous. Well, that sounds okay, but what does that mean? Everything is dangerous. Going on a bus is dangerous, certainly in Israel. Driving is dangerous. Crossing the street is dangerous. Even staying in bed can be dangerous. You know, I come from Washington, D.C., or Silver Spring, Maryland, outside of Washington, D.C. And I remember 6 years ago, in one of the black ghetto neighborhoods, there was crossfire between two drug gangs, and a bullet penetrated the cheap drywall of a building, and it killed an 8-year-old who was just in bed. The kid was sleeping. Bullet in the heart. So to make a statement, you're not allowed to do things that are dangerous, needs a lot more definition. So we qualify it with a word that doesn't help that much. You're not allowed to do things that are unreasonably dangerous. Okay. So you get the gist there. Certain things are allowed even if they're dangerous because they're normal. But how do you divide the normal and the abnormal? So there's kind of a circular definition. And the circular definition is that the types of activities that most people regard as the normal way you live your life is permitted even though they pose a certain incremental risk. That would include driving, bicycling, and the like. But activities that most people regard as unusually dangerous, you really shouldn't do. So this gets us into bungee jumping. This gets us into extreme sports like rock climbing. Now, when I use bungee jumping as an example, though, some people point out to me that if you look at the statistics of bungee jumping, it actually is statistically safer than driving a car. So maybe you have to revisit that. But what I would like to know is, I would like to know the differences between beginners and experienced people. Meaning, I think if you're combining beginning and experience, so it evens out. But maybe for beginners, I think there might be a higher risk. But be it as it may, I'm not going to give you concrete guidance here. But there is a distinction between unusual risk and normal risk. So now, let's talk about something which might be the most obvious example of dangerous behavior. Does halacha prohibit smoking? Now we know that in the old days, 100 years ago, not only was smoking not considered unhealthy, but smoking was promoted as something that was healthy. It helped digestion, it calmed the nerves, etc. But ever since the late 1960s, we now have an extremely detailed set of data about cigarettes as a major, major cause of lung cancer, emphysema, impaired breathing, cause of death. So the question becomes, halachically, is a religious Jew allowed to smoke? And by extension, we'll have a problem of secondhand smoke. Is he allowed, even if he smokes, is he allowed to smoke in a room with other people because of secondhand smoke? But even for himself, is he allowed to smoke? Because the fact, let me just go back a second. It is implicit in this whole scenario that the argument that it's my life, so whose business is it what I do, is totally rejected by Judaism. That Judaism says you have an obligation to take care of your life. So even if it's not an issue of secondhand smoke hurting other people, even if the only person I'm hurting is me, I have a halachic obligation to take care of myself. So am I allowed to smoke? So let me point out that you may have noticed already, I'm not sure what neighborhood you've been in, that in the Hasidic, very religious neighborhoods, the incidence of smoking is much higher than in the general public. And in Israel generally, even among whether you're religious or not, smoking is higher. Meaning, I think in the United States, smokers are not quite a vanishing breed, but smoking has declined precipitously. And thank God, that's a good thing. In Israel, it's also declined. It used to be a lot worse, but still, the proverbial smoke-filled room you will still get if you go to a wedding or bar mitzvah or the like. So let me point out that there are different views here. Obviously, it's best not to smoke, but in terms of whether halacha absolutely forbids it, here is the problem. The problem basically is, how do you deal with statistics? Mark Twain once remarked, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. Because here is a general, and I'm going to make up numbers because I actually don't have the numbers here. Here's the problem. When we say you're not allowed to engage in a dangerous activity, What if an activity greatly increases the magnitude of risk, but the actual incidence of risk is relatively small? Before I get to smoking, let me give you an example of a pesticide. Let's assume, again, I'm making up numbers, I just don't have statistics here. Let's assume that the incidence of a given cancer naturally occurring is 1 in 1,000,000. Let's assume, by virtue of a pesticide, it becomes 1 in 100,000. Is that pesticide unreasonably dangerous? So it depends how you describe it. One way of describing it is, the use of this pesticide increases the incidence of cancer 10 times, 1,000%. That sounds very scary. There's a 1,000% more likely chance you're going to get cancer with this pesticide than without it. Wow, that's scary. The other way of saying it is, 1 out of 100,000 people are going to get cancer. Well, that's a little less scary. And if we change the numbers a little bit, let's say the natural is 1 in 10,000,000, and this makes it 1 in 1,000,000. You see? In other words, the problem is, when we talk about unreasonable risk, are we referring to magnitude, or are we referring to incidence? I'm not sure if I'm using the correct technical terms. But something can still be a relatively small risk, but you've magnified it a lot as compared to the pre-risk behavior. Now, cigarettes pose a similar type of issue. Most people who smoke are not going to get lung cancer. But the magnitude, the risk factors are greatly, greatly, greatly increased. So some rabbis who, again, a lot of this might be political, they've been unwilling to prohibit smoking because people aren't going to listen, and in a sense, rabbinical authority, like all legal authority, tends not to be utilized if it's going to be ignored. But they've made this argument that magnitude of risk is not the same as incidence of risk. So perhaps you could create a justification. But again, I want to make it very, very clear. This is a post hoc justification for people who are hooked. Even the rabbis that didn't want to give a prohibition very much say you're not allowed to start, and people who are smoking should try to stop. But they didn't want to use the words forbidden and the like. But this is a major issue, the issue of incidence of risk versus, and again, as you analyze in your education, when we talk about things being dangerous, statistics can be described in many, many ways. You could say the risk factor is increased by 1,000%, or you can say 1 out of 1,000,000 people are going to get sick. Of course, what do they say about statistics? Even a 1 in 1,000,000 odds is not really acceptable if you're the 1 in 1,000,000, if you're the 1 out of 1,000,000 that gets cancer. Okay. But you can't create a risk-free society, because once again, if the odds are less than getting killed in a car, you know, it's very hard to forbid something if you're allowing people to drive in a car. Right? Now, another issue about risk is the issue of cost-benefit. And again, I'm going to use a pesticide example. Because you really create, you know, this rule that don't do dangerous things is intellectually a very difficult rule to actually apply. Let's assume that we have pesticides or genetic engineering or, you know, some type of technology that can increase a crop yield in Africa 20-fold. So, making up numbers, a given rice crop could yield, let's say, a million bushels a year. And via the technology of a pesticide or genetic engineering, you can now increase it to 20 million tons a year. As a result, people who would otherwise die of starvation will now live. In other words, people will live who would otherwise die. But at the same time, side by side with increasing the food production, you've introduced risk factors such as carcinogens and the like that may result in raising the risks of cancer that would otherwise not occur. So our problem is, I'm not supposed to do dangerous things, but what if the dangerous thing that I do will save lives who would otherwise not die? Do you do a cost-benefit analysis in the sense that, well, I'm going to save 1,000 people, and statistically, only 500 people are going to die by the risk factor. So based on utilitarian ethics, it is worthwhile to introduce this risk factor because the overall benefit in life enhancement is going to be greater than it would be had I left things to the status quo. Or do you say, well, wait a second here. It's impossible to know if the people who are going to die would have, in other words, essentially what you're doing is you're killing one group of people to save another group of people. Because you can't really say that the people who died of cancer would have died of starvation. Maybe they wouldn't have died, somebody else would have died. When you're working with statistics, you don't know who the people would be. So is it moral? I'm asking more questions than answers. Is it moral to save the lives of some people by doing things that will endanger the lives of other people? Is a cost-benefit calculus appropriate when the people who are going to be at the short end of the stick are people who perhaps would not have died under the status quo? This is a variation of a well-known problem in moral philosophy, which Judaism is very rich in, called the trolley problem. I'm driving a trolley, and I can't stop, and there are 5 children playing on the track. And if I keep on going, I'm going to kill 5 children. But I can turn the trolley onto a sidetrack. But there's a drunk that's sleeping on that sidetrack. So if I don't do anything, I'm going to kill 5. If I turn the trolley to the sidetrack, I'm going to kill 1. Is it justifiable for me to intentionally divert the trolley knowing that I'm going to kill 1 guy if the reason I'm doing it is to save 5? Or does my attitude have to be, I'm not allowed to make those decisions, I just got to keep the status quo, even if that kills 5? In a sense, it's an analogy, it's not an exact analogy. That is kind of the problem with the pesticides versus the crop production. I'm introducing a dangerous carcinogen, which, because of the enhanced food production, will save a lot more people. But as a result, some people are going to die who otherwise wouldn't die. Can I make that choice? Difficult, difficult, difficult. But the bottom line, on a simple level, is that we do have a duty to take care of ourselves, and that's difficult for another reason, because that's difficult, but it's not intellectually difficult. Intellectually, halacha is in favor of exercise, diet, self-control, and spiritually we believe that the ability to do mitzvot is only when you're able to physically serve God. If one is sick and ill, you cannot do all of the things that God wants us to do with our lives. So we do have a solemn responsibility. By the way, just an addendum to the trolley problem. That is, people raise the same question with the World Trade Center. You have an airplane with 200 innocent, besides the terrorists, you can kill the terrorists, that's not the question, but you have 200 innocent people heading towards the World Trade Center. If it hits the World Trade Center, 5,000 are going to die. Can we shoot down the plane and kill the 200 in order to save the 5,000? Or is that analogous to the trolley situation where you can't kill some people to save the others? The short answer is that shooting down the plane is justifiable, and it's not the same as the trolley case. In the trolley case, if you wouldn't divert the trolley, the drunk wouldn't die. So you can't kill him to save the 5, perhaps. Here, if the plane crashes into the World Trade Center, 200 people are going to die also. So as a result, you're not killing the 200 and saving the 5,000. The 200 are going to die one way or the other. If they're going to die one way or the other, then it's very clear there is a moral justification to maximize the saving of life. The trolley problem is it proper to maximize the saving of life if it's at the expense of killing somebody who otherwise wouldn't die? The World Trade Center is conceptually a different type of problem. Okay, you see the difference there. So don't confuse it. The distinctions are very subtle, and you have to pay very, very careful attention to the differences in those nuances. Okay, I guess we'll stop here. And, good to see you, and I hope you have a wonderful trip. When did this program begin? Is this the... Oh, okay, okay, yeah.
So with the trolley scenario,
yeah.
What do you do?
Well, in Jewish law, it's basically a machloket. What can I tell you? There are, again, it's hard to tell the driver, call up your rabbi, you know, before you hit. Yeah, but Maimonides would actually say you cannot make the decision and you have to allow the car to go its normal course. Rashi, I think, my view is the way I read Rashi, is Rashi would say that in a case like this, the saving of life would be, of maximizing life would be paramount. So this is a very, very difficult issue. But vis-a-vis the World Trade Center, I think there's a very strong case that everybody would say you could shoot down the plane. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Well, in the case of Charlie and the World Trade Center, how convinced do you need to be that these people are... You don't really know 100% whether or not they're going to die or not.
Yeah, no, I understand. Well, in that case, I think it was fairly clear, but you're right. I mean, you're raising a murky area. When things are not 100%, what percentages do we operate that allow you to make the judgment that I'm going to shoot them because they're going to die anyway? What if there's only a 80%? What if there's a 50%? What if there's a 20%? You know, at some point, clearly, if it's below 50%, it would not be justified. But once you're over 50%, I think there are going to be some open questions. But the World Trade Center, I think I would be relatively comfortable that particularly in the plane, people in the plane, indeed, was 100%. Mortality. Okay, and by the way, in spite of what you see on YouTube, Israel did not cause the towers to collapse. And for some reason, there are recurring rumor for 20 years already that, or not 20, 14 years, that the Mossad did it. Mossad did not do it, so don't worry about that. Yeah?
So going back to what you said, that you shouldn't do a dangerous thing that's like generally considered
yes.
dangerous. So a lot of people consider going to Israel or living in Israel dangerous.
Yeah, it is a good question, and people use that as an excuse. But all I can tell you is, statistically, it just is not true. It is true that when, God forbid, things happen, they might be big things like an airplane crash. Right? Air travel is safer than cars, but when an airplane crashes, it's a big deal. So when we occasionally have an event, it's a big deal. It makes the press. But statistically, the risks of being hurt in Israel are less than in the United States. And you will actually see, this is a very safe country, although things happen, and we're surrounded by mean people. But you will notice in Jerusalem that you can walk around at night, 12 o'clock at night, not in every neighborhood, but basically you see little kids walking around at night. I'll tell you, in Montgomery County, Maryland, where I was from, some parents were arrested because they were letting their 9-year-old play in a park without supervision during the day. You can't even do that anymore. Here, kids walk around at night. So people are, people in America are scared. They think Israel is like the Wild West. I hope you will discover, really, how safe this country is, and statistically it is absolutely safer than virtually every city in the United States. So the question you have to ask is, are you halakhically allowed to live in the United States? That is a dangerous society. Okay, all right, you have a good day, be well. We'll see you in a few days.